Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Hi everyone, I'm Miranda Sawyer. That's Philip Perry, so I'm Miranda Sawyer. I'm a journalist and broadcaster. I'm very happy to welcome you all to today's special event. Philippa is a psychotherapist, author and broadcaster. She's been a presenter for us a while. She's appeared on telly and radio programmes on all sorts of topics, ranging from children who lie to bipolar disorder to celebrity dating. But today she is joining us to share some of the wisdom, and it is indeed wisdom, from this book here, the book you wish your parents had read. So I have read this book, and before I knew I was going to come and talk to Philippa. You can see how many times I've kind of made little turnips here to help me parent. It's a really, really amazing book. It's not really a kind of a book that maps out a perfect family life. What it does instead is it's designed to help us cultivate emotionally healthy relationships with our children through effective communication and better understanding ourselves. This sounds incredibly jargonish. It is not jargonish. It's a really, really brilliant book. So the way that it's going to go today is we're going to hear from Philippa. She's going to talk for a short amount of time. Then me and her are going to have a conversation. And then it's over to you. So there will be time for questions about 15 minutes, 20 minutes from the end of the session. So think of your questions now, and we'll have them then. That's it. Enough from me. Shall we get started? Please welcome the fabulous Philippa Perry.
Perfect. Hello. I've been asked for a world-changing idea. You'll have to wait until I get to the end before I give you that. I'm going to start with a story about my father and me. My father one day overheard me say to another adult that I wasn't having a particularly happy childhood. He was furious. He came over, he shouted at me, "You have an idyllic childhood, a brilliant childhood. How can you say that, stupid girl?" And then I just felt confused and like I got something wrong. And I didn't feel any better. And I think this is the problem that we often have as parents. We want our children to be happy so much that we try to scold them into it, but that doesn't work. If we don't accept all of our feelings, all of a child's feelings, as well as just their happy ones, we are teaching a child that great chunks of them are unacceptable. What my dad could have done is, instead of telling me off for having inconvenient feelings, he could have tried to find out more about them. So how are you feeling? When do you feel that? Where do you feel that? Yeah, I can understand that. What he missed out then was a moment of connection. And what we want with our children more than anything are moments of connection, are a good relationship where we're both on the same page and we both get each other. Now, that is the main thrust of my philosophy, actually, is that we concentrate far too much on the child and correcting the child and moulding the child, and we don't concentrate half enough on our relationship. How are we interacting? How are we affecting each other? So we want to have a good, almost equal relationship with our children. But how do we then put down boundaries? That seems like impossible. We know that children want love, but they also need boundaries. So you love someone, but then you have to tell them no. It's a very difficult thing to navigate. But it's a lot easier when, instead of defining the child, you are this, you are that, you must, we instead define ourselves. You may be ready to take the night bus, but I'm not quite there yet. You're going to have to wait for me to be ready with the idea of you, age 13, on a night bus, because I'm not quite there yet. Nobody minds someone defining themselves, but if you say you are no way capable of catching that bus on your own. How does that feel when you get that? You just want to fight back. So define yourself and not the child when it comes to putting down boundaries. And this might be not only about catching night buses, but, you know, when you're with a four-year-old in the playground and they say, I want to stay here forever. And you say, we're going in 5 minutes because you've had enough. That's not very nice for them to hear as well. What they need to hear from you is the truth. They need a relationship with you. You have to be authentic. And so although it sounds like you're being selfish, you're not hiding anything when you say, I'm bored, I'm cold, so we're going in 5 minutes. When I tried this with my child, I just thought, she's going to think I am so selfish. But she accepted it so readily. Unlike when you say, you must, you've got to. It's so much easier to hear. And also, it teaches children emotional intelligence, because emotional intelligence, a great part of it, is knowing what you feel, and then from that, knowing what you want, and then asking for it. You might not get it, but at least you know who you are and where your needs and wants are coming from, which is your feelings. Now, this might seem quite long-winded, because what you want to say is, do this now! Because that seems like really quick and gets everything done very expediently. But it doesn't help your relationship with your child, which is what your child needs above all things. So there's no way of not investing time. You have to put the time in. And my golden rule for time is, invest it early first, positively, rather than try and get away with it and then have to invest an awful lot more time negatively later. Think of it like this. You're on a train journey with a toddler, and you've got colouring books, a packet of Sylvanian families or Lego or something, and a little picture book, and you just wish the kid would involve themselves with this stuff so you can get on with your novel. I mean, that's human. But if you go, ooh, what have we got here, and play with them first so that they don't have to work to get your attention, so that they know they can depend on you, then that frees them up to become involved in whatever games or toys they devise from whatever there is in front of them. So they might find you're not very good at talking Teddy or whatever it is, so they'll grab it off you and take over, and they'll talk Teddy, and then they'll get on what I used to call autopilot when my daughter reached this stage of being able to play with herself. And that didn't come out right. And then when she could play independently, that's a better way of saying it, when she could play independently, then I could get on with my novel. Now, this is true of independence in children in general. So the more you push your child to independence, the more they'll come back and want to cling to you. The more you're available and dependable, the freer they'll feel to go off and explore. So don't push them away. Just be there, be dependable, be available, and then they'll know they can come back to you when they want to take their explorations out into the world. So what I'm giving you examples of here is the relationship. So many relationships aren't equal relationships based on an mutual exchange, not based on dialogue. They're based on other dynamics that aren't so helpful. And these dynamics are rooted in childhood. And one of the worst ones, really, is what I call doer and done to. But you might think, well, of course I've got a baby here and I'm an adult. Of course I have to do to the baby. But you can be more collaborative than that. You can ask a little baby that hasn't learnt how to talk or even get eye contact yet, you know, whether it's okay if you pick her up. You can ask him if it's okay, if you're going to change the nappy now, and then wait for a response. In before children can talk, if you observe them, you'll see they have a natural turn-taking ability. You can take turns with them with facial expression, with little noises, with grimaces, with bodily gestures, and you can take turns. Rather than just doing to them, you can be in a relationship when it's far more turn-taking. And this is the forerunner for conversation. And if you think, well, it's too late because I just did to my baby rather than wait for the space, it's never too late because this is a relationship we're talking about. We're not making a sculpture out of stone. We're making a relationship where the two people in it, you and the child, are flexible, can be impacted by each other. If we get too stuck in doer and done to, if you're done to an awful lot, you become more and more inflexible because you don't want any more done to, you don't want any more being told this or that. And you become less flexible, and that makes you what I call diaphobic, which is when you won't allow mutual impact, you won't allow the other to impact you, you won't allow the other to influence you. I'm sure we can all think of someone like that. If you think about what relationships frustrate you the most, it's the ones where you don't make any difference. It's like talking to a brick wall. It's the same for our children, however young they are. So we do need to move away from manipulation, rewards, punishments, which are manipulation, and more to listening, observing, and collaboration. If you have a problem with your relationship with your child, see it as a problem that you define by your defining yourself, and then brainstorm together how you can come to a solution. So the child is part of the solution, rather than being left out and then done to. It will make for a better relationship. So we know we want great relationships with our kids. We know we want to be warm, understanding, accepting. So why doesn't this just happen naturally? Well, it does. And it does with other mammals. But we've had a way of interfering with this natural exchange of give and take, this natural way of being dialogic. We've interfered with it. And what gets in the way is our past. We tend to do as we were done to. And even if we think, well, I didn't like that when I was growing up. I'm never going to do that to my kids. How often have we opened our mouth and been surprised that one of our parents' words has come out? I opened my mouth and my mother's words came out. Which, if there were words that made us feel warm, accepted, safe, happy, that would be great. But so often they are words that made us feel the opposite. Whatever age our child is likely to remind us on a bodily level of what it felt like to be that size or that age. And if we didn't like how we felt, we won't want to be reminded. So we might try and push the child away. And it's not the child we're trying to push away from, even though it feels like that, oh, you're too much for me. What we're trying to push away from are the feelings our child is triggering in us. Let me give you an example. Mark came to see me. He's 42. He's married to Tony, who is also 42. And they have a young boy called Toby, who is 2. Mark was depressed, resentful, angry. He felt that his life was unsustainable. He just wanted to get away from the world of baby. It was too much for him. He resented all the things that we might resent when we're parents, like no spontaneity, no free time. It was Winnicott who told us that we've got many reasons to hate the baby. And we mustn't be surprised if sometimes we do hate the baby. And if we admit, like Mark did, that we do, we're far less likely to act on that hate. But Mark came to see me because he felt like he was on the verge of acting on that hate. And I asked him about his childhood. Oh, completely normal, fine, yes. But I dug a bit deeper, and his father left when he was two. And he'd had a very happy time with his mum, and he felt like he had a normal, good, happy childhood, which indeed he did. But what he had buried and locked in a little box was absolute dismay that his father left, sadness that his father left, fury that his father left. And when he was able to express that fury, unlock that sadness, he thought if he'd done that, it would have killed him. But he found that actually he could get through it in about 20 minutes. And it acknowledged to him what had been locked up inside him. And when he unlocked that pain, when he faced those feelings his kid was triggering in him, he could accept and love the kid and not want to push away from the kid. And there's many examples of this that come up a lot in my practice. For instance, one mother was furious that her kid wouldn't get down from the climbing frame and yelled at her. And the kid just was completely flummoxed as to why this was. And she said about a week later, "Mum, why did you do that?" And her mum, who is a trained psychotherapist, so didn't just say what we'd all say in that position, which is like, you could perfectly well get down by yourself, you were being silly. So easy to blame the child rather than look where our feelings have come from and they're triggered from our childhood. But she didn't do that. And she said, yeah, that's a very good point. When I was your age, Grandma wouldn't let me on climbing frames. I was jealous of you. And at that moment, I was really angry with Grandma, and not you, but I was in a muddle, and I didn't know. And her little girl just said, oh, I just thought you didn't care. And she said, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. And that's another thing we can always do. We will always make terrible mistakes with our children. We will misattune to them. We will misunderstand them. We will get the wrong end of the stick. We'll blame them for our bad moods. And it's normal to do all those terrible things like it is in all relationships. But we do them especially, unfortunately, to our children because they've got nowhere to run. They have to be with us. They've got no choice. And so we may relax that sort of good behaviour we might have with other people who have got freedom of abandoning us. Our children have no such freedom while they're children. But what we can do when we've done those terrible things like my friend did to her kid on the climbing frame, what we can do is we can retrace steps and we can go, that was horrid, that shouldn't have happened to you, or I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. And I call that process rupture and repair. And it's absolutely essential if you think, oh, it's too late for me, I've already messed up my kids. It's not too late. We're talking about a relationship. And you know, in all your other relationships, you have times when you're apart and then you have times when you repair and you get back on the same page again. It's essential we do that with our children. One mum once asked me, isn't it always necessary to be right with their children, with our children, otherwise they won't feel safe? No. It's really important to be authentic so we don't mess with their instincts. With your kid, you are setting up within them a blueprint for all their future relationships. Not only their future relationship with you, but their future relationships with the wider family, the community, society, and indeed, the world. And we want a world where people listen to each other, take their feelings into account, collaborate, and not a world where people are dismissed, done to, and manipulated. People do as they are done to, so let's do the best for our kids. And I'm optimistic, and it's really important to be optimistic that our kids will get where they want to be. And I'm optimistic that we can do this, and believe in your kids, that they can do this, and I believe in you. Thank you. Well, yeah, it's fine.
Okay. Right, shall we unpick some of the things that you talked about? One of the things I think that... I think everything that you say makes absolute sense, but sometimes you are, as a parent, I'm a parent of a 13-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I have stepkids who are much older who've got kids of their own. And one of the things I often wonder about parents is boundaries.
Yeah.
So you're taught, one has to put, perhaps, I suppose, boundaries around small children and then boundaries around teenagers so that you feel that they are safe. And perhaps within that you can negotiate or stuff like that. But you know, there are certain things that you feel like, okay, you can't do that. You know, like this is a really terrible idea. But can you do these kind of boundary setting without just saying, no, you can't do it?
We all have limits. So if your limit, say, is 8:30, put the boundary down at 8:00. If your limit is midnight, put the boundary down at 11. And our limit is when we blow our top or we just, you know, can't self-regulate, to use my jargon. And the boundary is where we keep ourselves safe. And so we put a boundary down by defining ourselves. I'm not happy with you out after 11 o'clock. I get cold in the playground after 3.5 hours. That would be a saint that said that. I was usually 40 minutes tops. But then the child knows where they are and they've got a structure that keeps them safe. And I think if you pretend that it's for outside reasons, such as I've read that 2 hours of screen time is the maximum day, therefore you're stopping watching the screen at 2 hours, that's really frustrating for a kid to hear. But if they hear, I can't hear any more of that television or those memes, or I really want to play a board game with you, so I want you here by whatever it is, just keep with the I statements. It's a habit to get into, and it makes boundary setting so much easier.
Yeah. What about with them? One of the things that you talk about in the book is with small children, which is obviously small children are prone to immense rages. And, you know, I mean, you know, proper tantrums in the supermarket, running off down the wrong way, all those kind of things. There's something you talk about which is called a boundary, which is containment.
Yeah.
Should we talk about that a bit? Because I found that incredibly revelatory, really.
When you've got a very small child and it comes to setting boundaries, it's, I can't let you pull the cat's tail, so I'm going to pick you up and remove you from the cat. Mm. And... they tend to be more physical because they don't really understand. They might understand a few words, but I think we over-rely on words and we need to use our bodies a bit more. And so it's like, I'm going to pick you up and put you in the playpen while I'm playing with these hot liquids. Mm. So it's...
So it's like informing them what you're doing.
It's informing them what you're going to do rather than just doing it, because I think it's very important to respect them as a separate body.
There's also a thing that that I found very useful, which is mentioned in other books, and you mentioned yourself as well, which is reflecting how they're feeling, but you have to understand what they're feeling in the first place.
That's tricky.
Yeah. Especially when they're really little.
Yeah, so suppose your kid's having a tantrum because they can't swim with the penguins in the zoo. I mean, it looks like a lovely swimming pool, so why the hell not? Mother has been incredibly unreasonable with this. So you go, oh, yeah, it would be lovely to swim with the penguins. What a pity you can't. And it's not allowed, and you're very upset. Let me give you a hug while you're upset about this. You'll feel better soon, but it's a no. Rather than, no, you can't. Because then they've got two things to cry about. One, they can't swim with penguins. And two, you're cross with them. So it's much better if when we... put down the boundaries, we do it kindly and we empathise with how horrible it must be not to be able to swim with the penguins, fly to the moon or have an ice cream before lunch. I'm not saying we give in to children and their demands. What I'm saying is that we're very kind when we put down the boundary.
If you imagine a kind of perfect scenario where we're all brilliant parents and we relate to our children fantastically, and then the children go out into the world, and unfortunately there are other people who have not been brought up so wonderfully, and those people are used to doing, being done by, and stuff like that. Yeah. Sometimes I worry as a parent, you know, we have fears that if you teach your kid to be really fantastic and nice, they'll go out in the world and everyone will be horrible to them.
No. For a start, kindness, you can practice it unilaterally, and it's research has shown that it's catching. Secondly, your kid isn't just being nice, okay? One of my bugbears is when people say please, say thank you, because a kid learns gratitude by being shown gratitude. So they learn how to be genuine. And so you say, oh, thank you for all those plastic cups of pretend tea for about 4 hours. And that is not wasted time, that is time invested. And so they learn gratitude, so they're comfortable. And because they've got a safe place at home with you, if someone is horrible to them, it's not the end of the world. They've got a safe place to go. And they also, because they're so used to saying, I feel this, so I want that, that they've got a sense of who they are. So they can't be knocked off so easily, say, by a bully.
Okay, brilliant.
Bullies, by the way, come about by playing a game at home called winning and losing. If we always have to dominate our kids by being the one that's right, by being the one that wins all the argument, the kid will then either become in the role of victim or bully, because those are the two roles they've learned. I just thought I'd sneak that one in.
It's very true, I think. But what about if they come against institutions? Because I think that sometimes you can really try and do the right thing around your child at home, but then they go to school, and school, I mean, school is discipline. School literally is people doing to your kids all the time.
Yeah, so I think that if they've had some flexibility at home and they realise that they are not invisible and they can make an impact by just talking reasonably rather than having to be naughty, they can talk to you about that, and you can go, yeah, this seems to be a bit of a problem for you. How do you think you're going to solve this problem? We don't solve their problems for them. We facilitate them brainstorming to solve their own. I mean, sometimes if something ghastly is happening, we might have a quick word with the head.
Yeah.
And
what about, there's a kind of modern phenomenon of helicopter parenting, which is the idea that the parent is always present. So whoever it is, a small child or even an older child, that the parents will... an extreme example I remember reading about is where children take their A-levels, they're maybe going to go to university, and their parents either come with them or check the university out themselves to make sure that everything is perfect before the child is allowed in.
Well,
It seems to me that comes from fear, isn't it? It's like a...
Yeah, I mean, if you self-define and go, I'm a very nervous, scaredy person, and I want to see where you're going to be, is that all right? The child can then go, Mum, you've really got to grow up a bit.
Move away.
I'm so going to do this on my own. Or they can go, sure, you can come with me. I mean, it's about a relationship. What I don't like is when people say, what shall I say to my child when? As though everything is sort of from a phrase book. Relate. You know, have a dialogue to and fro. A friend of mine has got an autistic son. And she read an awful lot of parenting books about how to be with the child, and she'd learn all these phrases that you're supposed to say to a child, and this autistic child, and I thought autistic people weren't able to read other people very well, but this kid was very canny. He'd go, Mum, you're using your special voice again. I want to avoid the special voice. I want us to have dialogue to and fro, observe our kids, respond to our kids, see whether we've got that right, if not, make an adjustment. Yeah. Just like we do naturally in all our relationships. I don't want us to sort of have special rules, really, for our children. I mean, obviously, they're younger and they're in our protection and they need our care. But that doesn't mean to say we don't respect them like we respect other people.
or that we're not changed by them. That's what I always think is quite interesting, because, you know, I think perhaps when you have a child, and in the early part of having a baby, it's like a bomb's gone off in your life, and you may think, I can't remember who I am. But that's quite normal. Why would you, you know, you've been changed by the child arriving.
Yeah. I think if we've been done to a lot, we get very scared of changing at all. If we've got over, through 20 years of therapy in my place, the doer and done to thing, it's a lot easier to be flexible and to keep changing when someone else comes along. What is so magnificent, though, is allowing their influence, allowing ourselves to see their world through their eyes, expands our own world such a lot. And that's when it all becomes a lot of fun.
Yeah, more fun. One of the things in your book that I really enjoyed was your unpicking of the way that we argue, and I mean kind of adults and children, how one might argue. And I just wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about that. So it's to do with facts and feelings, or distraction, or you know, how you unpick a kind of moment of conflict, really.
Well, I can't give you all the dynamics I've put in the book, but... one of them is something I call fact tennis. So you go out to work, you do the washing up, you go out to work, you come back, pile of washing up in the sink. So you say, it's unhygienic to leave washing up in the sink. I wish you'd do it all at the same time. Offering a fact there. And then your partner comes back with, or your child comes back with, it's okay, I'm going to soak it all and do it at the end of the day. So that's 15 all. And then he said, well, I don't like the way it attracts flies. 30-15. There are no flies. It's winter. 30 all. And so on until one of you runs out of facts. A better way to deal with difference is, instead of playing fact tennis, is to deal with your feelings. I feel a sense of despair when I see the washing up, when I come back, when I've done it. Oh, babes, you're despairing. Oh, I'm sorry, didn't have time to do it. I've been so busy. Yeah, I can see you're busy. Do you mind if we do it now? You wash and I'll dry, because I can't bear it. I don't want you to be unhappy, so I will do that. If you both... Unilateral kindness works. Being a martyr doesn't. Share your feelings about everything, I think.
And then that hopefully will work. One of the you mentioned...
In a contained way.
Yes.
Rather than, I'm furious.
I
get angry when is better than after you've got angry. But, you know, we don't get all these things right.
No. Well, we don't. But that's if you talk about that. If you feel like, you know, one of the things I felt perhaps when I was reading the book, I was like, oh my goodness, I've been doing this all wrong. And as I said, one of my children is 13. So I was like, oh my goodness, he's got to 13 and I've done it all wrong. Some bits right, but, you know, some
you
wrong.
You have not done it all wrong. But you've got a relationship with him, a good relationship.
But there
with
is
him.
An element where you might feel, oh, I've started off wrongly. How can, you know, if early childhood is as important as I think you
it is
think
it is.
How
important.
Can you make it better?
Well, I don't know what terrible things you've done to poor old Paddy, but can you give me an example what you think you might have got wrong?
Let me think. I mean, I suppose sometimes I think it's again a thing to do with doing and done to. I think sometimes children might find it hard to express their own feelings. So you might say, well, you know, how are you feeling about this? And they might not feel legitimised to express their feelings,
right,
or they might not
okay.
know how to say
so
it.
So what you can say is, like, you get a specific example of saying, like, when you said you were really sad about missing football last week, and I said, oh, never mind, I've got the new Star Wars movie to watch. I don't know, there is a new Star Wars movie. It's all, you know. Never mind, I've got this movie for you to watch. I'm sorry, because I actually pushed your feelings about the football away. How are you feeling about the football now? Yeah, it's tough. It's still being cancelled. You can...
kind of repair it.
You can repair it. I have a little phrase for this, which is rupture and repair. I know it sounds a bit like an anal fissure, but I don't mean it like that. The rupture is when we miss a tune, where we get something wrong, where we maybe speak out of turn, or... belittle their feelings about missing football practice or whatever it is. And the repair is when oh, I'm sorry I just pushed you aside when you were upset about football last week. That was bad of me, I'm sorry. Yeah. My bad.
My bad.
My bad are two great words for parents, actually. What surprised me, because I didn't want to bring my kid up like I'd been brought up, so I got into the habit of saying, I'm sorry that happened to you, or my bad, on that sort of thing. And I was so surprised when she was about 3.5, 4, she was eating a piece of cake in the kitchen. I can still remember where she was standing. She looked at me, calm as anything, and go, sorry I was grumpy in the car, Mum. I was hungry. I'm fine now. I thought, she's so apologised to me. She's been flexible with me. She's thinking about our relationship. She's perceived a little rupture. I can't remember it, but fair enough, I'll take it. And she's trying to put it right. And I just thought, isn't that great? And the same with gratitude, the same, you know, we want kids that are able to go, my bad, and apologise. And they learn that from you. When you say, my bad, and apologise. In the same way they learn thankfulness, because you love all those plastic cups of tea, don't you?
Yeah, they're delicious. Especially the plastic cake, I find is really delicious.
Oh, yum, yum.
Which bit, when you were writing the book, I find myself that if you're writing a book, you tend to, it can help you understand even more. There's something about the act of writing that makes you understand. Did you find anything in the book that kind of you thought, oh, I understand it even more just by writing a book?
I think it was the doer and done to thing. I really got it. Because when I'm working with adult patients, some of them, the only influence they can allow is the early toxic influence of I'm no good, I'm bad. That sort of like, I got it wrong for dad thing. And they don't want to flex away from that or allow anyone else. So they get very incredibly lonely, because relationships are made of give and take, not just pushing away and giving and stuff. And I think I really got where that had come from by researching it and writing it.
And what about you yourself? So you a parent, your daughter is now left home. Which bits when you were actually parenting yourself, which bits were the bits that you found the easiest, and which bits were the bit you found the hardest?
I think the hardest thing for me was there's a bit in the book called negative self-talk. And I think we can all be our own worst critics. And I think we can all be very hard on ourselves, like this whole thing. And, you know, sort of think that, you know, we're ugly, or we get everything wrong, or not for the likes of me. And I think if we have this internal voice, and we are a little bit merged with our children, we can pass on that internal voice. And my daughter often picks me up about it. And, you know, I can be looking in the mirror and going, oh, I look so old. And she'll go, oh, stop it, Mum. I think, oh, God, yes. Because I remember my mother looking in the mirror and being dissatisfied with her own reflection. And here was I doing it to my daughter, even though I'd hated it when my mum had done it to me. I want to be a better role model about getting old. So I look absolutely bloody terrific.
As you always do, Philippa.
Thank you. And that was for you, Flo.
So, look, I'd like to throw it open to the audience. We've got a few minutes before we finish. We can carry on. To be honest, me and Philippa can carry on talking quite happily for about another 5 hours. But I believe you're here to talk to Philippa. So I see your hand first, because you're right in my eye line, and you put your hand up straight away. So
can
I think we should go to you.
Can you stand up so I can hear?
Oh, is there a microphone coming? Oh, there is, brilliant. And then we can see you, though. If you feel like standing up, it's lovely to see you.
Yeah, I want to have a look at you. Hello.
Is that working?
Yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to ask about the I'm cold, I want to go home thing. And two parts. One is, I have rheumatoid arthritis, so I'm constantly thinking about boundaries of that level of, like, when they want to get picked up, and it's better not, I mean, it's just eight, but I found that really a challenge to want to, and sometimes it overcompensate. So there's that part of it. But within that, the I'm cold, I'm five, I mean, I'm cold, I want to go home. I'm thinking, when I'm saying that, I want to be, I'm always thinking ahead to the fact that I'm going to want to take her to a museum, and I don't want her to say that to me and me have to leave the museum. So what's that boundary?
You negotiate, don't you? Suppose you're going to a friend. Suppose you're going to the museum with your friend, not your five-year-old. And your friend said, oh, can we stuff this and go and have a cake? What do you go? You go, actually, I really want to go and see these Roman remains. Then we can go and have a cake. You compromise. You negotiate, you compromise. And you want your child to have those skills of negotiating and compromise. And you really want your child to have the skills of, I know what I feel, so I know what to ask for. And so, and please, put that boundary down before you start hurting too much.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, another question.
Hello.
This one? Yeah, you, hello.
Hello.
You've just confirmed lots of things. I encourage my daughter to say I want a lot.
Yeah.
And she was at her grandfather the other day, some time ago, and he said, I want never gets. Uh-huh. I had to self-regulate and not strangle him. I don't know how to explain it.
Okay. I tell you what happened to me. A very similar thing happened to me. Like when my daughter was about two, she just had a growth spurt and she grew about an inch. And we were around at grandfather's and she stood up underneath the grand piano. I know, posh house, I know. We stood up underneath the bright grand piano and clonked her head. And of course she was terribly upset. So I was comforting her a lot. And, you know, while she got over a bumped head. And he said, don't do that. She'll want to hurt herself all the time. You mustn't comfort her like that. You must just tell her off for hitting her head and being clumsy. And I thought, so much sense. So much sense I'm making of my childhood now. Thanks, Dad. That's probably about three or four therapy sessions you've saved me. And so...
So would you say that you just...
You've got there is like, well, grandfather's different to me. And I think this is interesting. Like, you know, your partner might say, bed, 7:30. And you might say, oh, you can stay up as long as you like. It's the school holidays. I don't mind. Let's have fun. Watch Toy Story again and again and again. And they might say, you let me stay up. Dad says 7:30. Who's right? And actually, this is what's right. Dad's limit is 7:45. So for him, he wants you in bed at 7:30. That's him. I'm me. Neither of us is right. Neither of us is wrong.
But what time did the kid go to bed?
Well, it depends if we're at Dad's house or Mum's house, doesn't it?
You only wins that fight.
Yeah.
Okay, next question. Do we have another question like this? Yes, you in the middle. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned that you need to invest time, but, you know, when you don't have a lot of time,
okay,
how do you manage that?
Okay, good question. You cannot get out of it. You cannot get out of investing time. If you skimp at the beginning with like hacks and tricks and manipulations, you will have to spend the time later on correcting that because they're angry or because they feel insecure or because they're still clinging to you when they're age 12 or something. The more secure and happy and safe they feel because of your availability when they are young, the less time you'll have to invest later. So it's a bit of, it's the train journey. Just keep, if you've got a pile of work to do and you say to your two-year-old, you've got to play with your doll's house by yourself for an hour and a half while I get through the spreadsheet. They will be going, I've tried it. They will pull your hem and so you won't be able to work anyway. Because they'll even go, Mum, can I have an apple? Which always gets your attention, because you go, oh, fruit, yes. You know, they'll find a way of getting your attention. How we train our kids to be a pain is by trying to push them away. And kids that are a pain will take up more of your time than kids who can take your attention for granted.
So it's your best bet, like say if you have a kind of full-time job and you're out of the house and the smaller child is perhaps at school and then it's a childminder or at a school club, would your best bet be then when you come into the house to, because quite often when you come into the house there's a list of things that need to be done, would your best bet really be to spend half an hour with your child, just with your child?
Your best bet is to light up as soon as you see them, because you are a human mirror for them. And light up and allow that exchange to happen. Do not put it off. They will go to sleep eventually, and then you can get through that list. Or they will be satisfied with how much of your attention they can have, and then they've got much more interesting things to do than play with you anyway. And I'm sorry to put that to you. If you are available and they're absolutely certain of that, and if you say, come and help me make dinner, we'll do it together. If you've got something you just cannot put off, like making dinner, let's do it together. They'll go, no, you're all right, I'm going back to my Xbox.
Well, shall we talk really quickly? Actually, I feel like we should talk a little bit about kind of electronics, about screens and Xboxes and PlayStation 4s. What is your kind of attitude towards those? Because kids can get very, very involved in screens.
My attitude is very strict on the parents, very flexible on the children. So I say, do not get in the habit of using your iPhone for connection, because you've got a hunger for contact when you're with your baby or very young child. They have got the same hunger for contact, and they want that from you. So be very grown up and be very disciplined and keep your phone in your bag. So that's number one. Number two, children and electronics. Well, isn't it great that you've learned how to have conversations and you can collaborate, because then you can have, and you can define yourself and not the child, then you can have all those conversations that are quite difficult about electronics, about porn, about other people, whatever it is. You can have difficult conversations if you've learned how to talk. You cannot start talking to a kid age 10 when you've just been telling him what to do up until then, rather than have a to and fro exchange. Then the conversation is very difficult. And if that's the way it's been, you're going to have to backtrack and allow his impact and influence, or her impact and influence, on you. So the way to have difficult conversations is to have conversations and have them from the moment you can hold a baby up and take turns to make faces at each other.
Okay. Another question? I see you on the front row, actually. Hello.
I have a daughter who's 14, nearly 15, and my husband and I are very reflective and thoughtful and do a lot of the things that you suggest. My daughter's not very thoughtful, and
you're picking it up, love. Have confidence, optimism. She will get there because you are her example.
And doesn't wish, and isn't very articulate, and doesn't wish to have a lot of connection with us. So, for instance, if she we hear very little about her relationships at school, apart from that people are annoying, or they did stuff, or what sort of stuff, boring stuff. I mean, it does sometimes get better than that, but how can we help her talk to us more? We already model tons of talking to each other, and let's talk about our day. How was your day? My day was this, and let's, you know, we do all that stuff. How can we help her
think and talk more? Okay, I'm going to stop you, because your focus is, how can we help her? I want your focus to be, how can I improve my relationship? So the focus off her, she's like this, she's like that, and onto us. Onto me and her, and onto self-defining. So rather than, I want you to open up more, it's, I feel really curious about, or I wonder what that's like for you, and staying back. And the more we chase someone, the more they run away in any relationship. So it's you say how you feel. I really wonder what it's like for you at school. I can't imagine. And as soon as you get some information, what do you feel about that? It's sort of like, oh, if a couple of kids left me out like that, I feel like you do. I mean, those moments of connection, when you feel you actually connect, that's what you're after. You're after connection. You're not after getting them to feel the right things.
Can I say, when you don't talk to me, I feel rejected and lonely?
No, it's a little bit victim-y, isn't it? How about, and that's sort of guilt-tripping, which is a bit manipulative, going over to manipulation. So it's, I'd love to know. I'm really curious to know what it's like for you at school. And then when you hear, it's like, oh, I guess you don't want to talk about that right now. Get on the same page. The thing is with kids and feelings and talking is, if you think about you're the driver and the kid is the car, and you're going along an icy road and you get into a skid, and the car's, that's the kid, is going off like that. You put the wheel over here like that to try and get out of the skid, but the car is going in this direction. In order to get in the same direction and steer where you want to go, you have to steer into the skid. Steer into the skid, and then you can steer out of it. This analogy doesn't work so well since anti-lock brakes, but it used to before. So steer into the skid, and then you steer out, which means slowing down, not wanting results, not having an agenda. It means being with where they are now. I recommend the film Lady Bird, between a mum. It's a film about a mum and a teenage daughter. And they have terrible rows. And at one point, the mum said, I just want you to be the best you can be. And the kid is so frustrated because the mum is not accepting her as where she is and how she is now. That's what our kids need from us. Some acceptance as to where they are and optimism that they'll get where they'll need to be. Acceptance plus optimism.
It's a good approach. Okay, I think we've got time for a couple more, and then I think we might have to wrap up. Hello, I see you. Hello. I see you because you're right in front of me.
I'm really picking up on the defining self part of it, and my children have the misfortune that I'm also a psychotherapist. And I know I spend my life putting the focus on other people, so this is quite a challenge for me to actually really take account of what's going on for me. But I just wanted to ask you about really understanding that we're not all built the same. And I'm aware that I'm quite an introvert, for example, so this is quite scary.
Yeah.
But that my son is quite an extrovert, yeah. One of them. I'm also aware that there are all sorts of sort of hardwired differences. And whilst I love talking about emotions, my son doesn't particularly like talking about emotions. What he likes is walking alongside one another or cooking alongside one another. And that tends to produce just as much valuable contact sometimes as talking in that much more intense,
way. I don't think our kids want the equivalent of psychotherapy from us. Okay. You know, when I say facilitate, I think walking, cooking, long car journeys, when you're side by side, and there's space. What our children need is space in order to express and talk about themselves. And I'm glad you brought up difference, because once I was taught this by my child. Once I was at a party, and she was about 11, and I saw another 11-year-old in the distance at the party and went, oh, look, there's another 11-year-old over there. And she looked at me like this. She said, oh, look, there's another 52-year-old over there. seven-year-olds aren't the same, all seven-year-olds aren't the same, all babies aren't the same, and all 52-year-olds certainly aren't the same. And I went, point taken. You'd much rather cling to my skirt, wouldn't you, at this point? Yes, I would. Okay.
Okay. I have time for, we've got time for one more question. You've had your hand up right at the back. Hello. Would you like to say something?
First of all, this is fabulous, can I just say? Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Fabulous. I've got a 21-year-old and a 17-year-old, so I'm still doing it, still at it. And I just wonder whether... We've talked about difference. I wonder, I've observed differences in the boy and the girl. They are different people, they have different emotional intelligence, but also the different relationships in a heterosexual family. You've got a father, daughter, father, son, mother, daughter, mother, son. There's lots of multiple relationships in that. And I wonder if you've... Just any observations from you, really, about the difference in parenting a son or a daughter in some of those difficult times, because they do react differently to things, actually, okay. And they do react differently to the mother or the father, depending yeah. on the gender. Yeah. Just wonder if you've got anything on that. Thanks.
What children react differently to is different people. And because it's so easy to call them the youngest, the oldest, the boy and the girl, because it's such a short form, that's what we tend to do. And I was talking to a mother the other day who had a son, and she really wanted a daughter, and she had another son. And she told me years later, oh, I'm so glad I had two sons, because had my second child been a girl, I would have said, boys are like that, and girls are like this. But actually, now I say, John's like that, and George is like this, because they're so different. And it's so exciting. You know, in a big family, all the different relationships between siblings, between one parent and another, and I think each relationship is unique. And children sometimes will ask you, and it will break your heart, which one of us do you love the most? And if you're not careful, you will say, I love you both the same, because your heart is breaking. But that isn't true, and they know it. So what you say instead is, I love Sadiq like Sadiq, and I love Mary like Mary. It's a very, you know, mixed marriage, this is fine. And suppose you've got more in common with Sadiq. You know, you understand them much easier. So in some ways you feel closer. But Mary's a mystery with unpeeling layers the whole time. And so you love her in a different way. What's she going to show me next? So it's love. You love people differently as to who they are. You know, I love all my friends, but I love them in different ways. You know, they're dead now, I'm afraid. I loved my mother and my father, but I love them in different ways. We don't love someone the same. So we are fobbing our kids off when we say that, I love you both the same. I love you in different but equal ways.
Okay. It is 2:00. I'm aware that all of you may well have jobs to go to. But I would like to say thank you for being an absolutely fabulous audience.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And thank you to the wonderful Philippa Perry.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.